Fighting in a war is hard enough. You have to battle the enemy. They're trying to kill you. They're trying to defeat you. It's a lot harder when you're also helping the enemy by defeating yourself. And I think we're being honest that there's almost no way to put this with the Ukraine side other than their own actions are at least as detrimental to their future and in some ways worse than the enemy on the Russian side. Now, if you think we're exaggerating here, let's take a look at some of the facts and some of the physical evidence that we have before us. And I think you're going to come to the conclusion, if anything, we might be underselling some of this. And to try to help us make sense out of some of this, we have back with us today Mr. Patrick Henningsen, host of the Sunday Wire, patrickhenningsen.substack.com, and just all around great guy. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Danny.
Well, listen, let's just jump right into it. There was an article, interestingly, and this may seem a little bit off topic when I put it up there, but it's actually directly in line with it, in Responsible Statecraft by Jennifer Kavanaugh. We've had her on the show a few times. The headline of the author of the article is "A Trump Offer That Putin Cannot Refuse," with the subhead of "Every Threat Has Failed and It's Too Late for the U.S. to Just Walk Away from the Ukraine War. Washington has something Russia wants badly." And then you get into it, and there's a little bit more illuminating. In this, she writes, "In the eyes of many Ukrainians, any peace deal achieved with Russia now will be temporary. Rightly or wrongly, they believe that Putin will not be satisfied until Russia controls all of Ukraine. Today, the choice is not, therefore, between peace and more war, but between fighting Russia now and fighting Russia later. Facing this dilemma, Kiev has chosen a slow battlefield loss over quick capitulation. This is an understandable but dangerous strategy, however, that places the country's survival on a knife's edge." Now, I'm not sure I would agree with it here that it's understandable, because to me, to choose a slow loss in the belief and the expectation that you'll fight them again later, which you may not, and I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest you wouldn't, is to say we're going to potentially commit national suicide by impaling ourselves on the Russian bombs, as opposed to finding some kind of negotiated way out. How do you see it?
Well, that's a good analysis. And Responsible Statecraft, you see a lot of these good think pieces. But I think what the underlying subtext of that is, and this is the thing that usually our media commentators get wrong, is that they discount the political factor. And the political factor within Ukraine, in other words, what is the national appetite for this conflict, for the regime, for Zelensky as a sort of lame duck dictator out of mandate now a year and a half. So that's a clock that just continues to tick. And if the strategy is to do the slow waltz with the bear for a long grind, then the political part of that equation looks worse and worse as time goes by. And that's exactly what's happening. You can see the wagon circling, as it were, on Zelensky with this latest corruption scheme. But that's just, it's just a symptom of what's happening, is this kind of the corruption that sets in, the rot that sets in. Anytime you throw large amounts of cash, large amounts of liquidity into a corrupt system, or a system that's economically completely depraved and is a sieve effectively when it comes to efficiency and free cash coming from the West, whether it's in the form of loans or aid or other things, weapons, the graft is obvious from this latest corruption scandal. So this situation is just going to get worse and worse. There's going to be more animosity from the public. You can see the conscription program is not working. People are not responding to the call to die for their country. So it's going to be progressively worse and worse. But that's not stopping. This is the problem with this. Normally, these would be the signals to come to the negotiate table, cut your loss. But this is a unique thing in history. This is the first kind of multinational official proxy war. Maybe in the modern era, where the entirety of Europe and the West are quite happy to continue to prop up Ukraine as a cudgel against Russia, and with no regard at all as to what this is doing to Ukraine as a country, to its society, to its population, to its military, for that matter. They're still talking about, the EU defense minister was talking about using Ukraine's military as a security guarantee for Europe. I mean, they're coming up with creative ways in their mind to justify what they're doing and effectively doubling down on this massive sunken cost fallacy that the West is engaged in.
I wonder what your thoughts are on what, if anything, can we divine from this issue of the latest corruption scandal involving this right-hand man of Zelensky, who was being investigated for $100 million worth of corruption, although we've had other guests on our show who said that that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's other ones around $48 billion or something like that. These things have been going on for a lot of years, but they've been going on kind of a, I don't know, with a wink and a nod from the West. I remember during my time in Afghanistan on my second combat deployment, which was right about the transition time for Karzai, and on the ground, everybody knew that he was, you know, just completely corrupt. And I mean, to the point of bags of cash, pallets of cash, everybody knew it on the ground there. And of course, every time the camera started rolling, anybody asked a question, especially in the United States, it's like, no, there's no corruption here at all. We have people on the ground to make sure all this kind of stuff, but we knew it didn't. And Karzai was getting money out, you know, hand over fist. And then that was when I was there in around the 2010, 2011 period. Then at the end, when the very end came, the then president of Afghanistan again was moving large sums of money, and we were still shoveling a lot of it in there. And even though a lot of the military commanders could see the end was coming, they kept on going as long as they could, skimming all of, as much money as they could. And then the whole thing just collapsed in about a 3-week period. I mean, like completely collapsed. When they thought it was going to last for a long time. Do you see any potential corollaries between those two? And might that tell you anything about where we are in this war?
Well, I think there is similar. It's a interesting story you brought up there. That I think the main difference between the situation in Afghanistan, what you have in Europe, is so many governments and the European Union, the super state, the supranational body of the European Commission, are also playing a direct role in keeping this thing going. So it's like it's almost like the corruption scandal. This one is, to me, indicative of the potential breakdown of at least the U.S. the complete, you know, unconditional backing of the Zelensky regime, because the scandal's coming out of NABU. And NABU, the anti-corruption agency, was set up by Victoria Nuland and the U.S. Embassy.
Oh, I missed that origin part.
Yeah, in 2014. So this came in during that sort of Maidan, the whole Maidan thing, and then was kind of formalized when Petro Poroshenko was installed as president in the spring of 2014. And the reason they set up NABU, this is what you have to understand. There's SAPO and NABU. SAPO is the Ukrainian agency. It's mostly more or less Ukrainian run. NABU was overseen by the United States, and they even had their sort of loyalists that were installed in the key positions. I know this because we did at 21st Century Wire a lot of deep reporting on the Hunter Biden and Burisma and Biden corruption in Ukraine. We have a great archive on this. And so what the whole point of NABU, this is my opinion, obviously I'm not alone in this, that the U.S. set it up not to stop corruption in Ukraine, but to surveil corruption, to protect the corrupt elements that they wanted to keep quiet and keep undercover, and to bust anybody. It's like having bouncers at a nightclub, and the bouncers control the drug dealing inside, and they only bust the drug dealers that aren't paying their 10% or their 50, whatever, their cut. So this is what NABU was. And I think personally, it was also done to protect a lot of the Biden corruption and to prevent a prosecutor general like Viktor Shokin or independent investigators like Alexander Dubinsky, who's in jail, like Konstantin Kulik, who was threatened with jail by Zelensky and left the country, like Andre Durkash, who was investigating and had to flee the country. So anybody that was actually trying to do anti-corruption work was being threatened by the U.S.-backed Ukrainian puppets. And so NABU was just there to kind of manage that whole thing so the U.S. had a heads up in advance, were ahead of the curve on all of these various things that were breaking. But the fact that this scandal comes out of Nabu and fingers Zelensky's main bagman, who it was his partner in the media conglomerate, his name was Mindich, and this was bankrolled by Igor Kolomoisky, who's a Ukrainian oligarch, who Zelensky arrested, I think probably also to somewhat protect him, to keep him in jail, because it's a semi-safe place to be in this environment. But the fact it came out of Nabu means that the U.S. is not providing that super layer of protection for Zelensky, and it's hit his inner circle. So this is invariably going to hit public confidence in Ukraine, but also in Europe. Although the Europeans won't, you know, come out and say they're worried about this, and the, you know, the lead at the leadership level, the Donald Tusk level, the von der Leyen level, the Merz level, the Macron level, they're not going to say there's any problem with this corruption thing. You saw Macron; he's wrote in there immediately as a response to the corruption scandal. Did this whole public relations show with Zelensky signing on for, you know, like weapons that haven't been manufactured yet with for money that nobody has. 100 Rafale jets, you know, it's they don't even
see look at those smiles there, man. He's like, this is working great.
So what they're signing here is not an arms deal. What they're signing is a memorandum of understanding. It is a non-binding memorandum of understanding. There's not an arms deal. They don't have the pilots for these Rafale jets aren't available, haven't been built yet, or they're old block models that haven't been retrofitted yet. Yeah. So we're talking 10 years. Zelensky's going to be long gone. He's either going to be on a ski slope in Geneva or the beach in Miami living next to Yair Netanyahu or somewhere else, you know, but he's not going to be there. So whatever they're signing is null and void, probably by.
Okay. So help me understand this then. And I'm afraid of your answer as I'm even forming the question in my mind. Is it just as blatant as they're setting this up? So if Macron was there to try to forestall some of the negative impact and the loss of confidence, et cetera, and all of this corruption that came into light, they know they can't win. I can only imagine that they know that they cannot militarily win. And yet, are they just saying, okay, let's just keep this limping train going a little bit longer, as long as we can, before that they literally just die on the vine. So I'm going to let that go in here, as opposed to saying, all right, well, this is not helping. This is not working anything. Let's bring this to an end. I mean, why would they do that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One of them is there's a big shiny object on the shelf that everybody wants to get their hands on, and that's called Russian assets, okay? $320 billion worth of frozen Russian assets, $180 billion of which is located in Belgium in the Euroclear, which is the clearinghouse and with the SWIFT system and the international clearance system. And they've seized there and other central banks, they've seized these Russian assets. So all the money where this is going to come from is going to be from that. And the Europeans are banking on grabbing that money to pay for all this, and they think with the Russian money, they'll be able to kind of keep this party going for at least two or three more years, maybe 5 years.
So why haven't they gotten it so far? Because they've obviously been talking about this from the beginning of the war, and yet nearly 4 years in, they still haven't. What's the hesitancy?
Well, for first of all, Euroclear is based in Belgium, and Belgium has rejected categorically this move by Brussels or this initiative to steal the Russian assets, because it would set an awful precedent legally. And it means that not only that, because the U.S. is sanctioning lots of different countries now, they're threatening sanctions, they're doing tariffs, punitive tariffs. So it could even be an allied country of the U.S. that could get threatened with secondary sanctions in the future. So this is a test case that could destroy this entire SWIFT system or confidence in it for half of the world. And we're talking, you know, the BRICS block represents 20% of global GDP, and increasing by the year, probably with the productivity gains of China, Brazil, India, for example. And people are at the same time fleeing the dollar. So while this would give a short-term opium hit to Europe for its finances, in the long term, it would really destroy this system of globalization that the West has painstakingly constructed.
Okay, but I mean, I can get the whole shiny object thing and want that, but I mean, we got to be honest. In the larger terms of economies, 300 and whatever billion, it ain't that much money. I mean, is it really worth risking all of that future for a handful of dollars today?
It is a lot for Europe. This is a lot of money. Maybe not as much from a U.S. perspective, but for Europe, it is a lot of money. You're talking about Europe that has a GDP projected growth for 2026, a very optimistic projection of 1.1% GDP growth, 1.1%. So this is the advanced economy of the world in 1.1%. So how they're planning to pay for it now, before they steal these Russian assets, are basically that they're calling it the safe instrument. This is what Ursula von der Leyen and the others are punting out. And the safe instrument is to basically create euro bonds or war bonds for Europe. But then those are interest-bearing bonds. And then they're going also to charge interest and give that money to the individual member states as a loan. So there's two layers of interest on it. And so they're going to create bonds to loan member states so they can buy weapons for Ukraine. So they're calling it joint procurement. Okay. So there's no money here, Danny. That's what I'm saying.
Where are they going to pay the interest on these bonds when they come to mature?
I'll tell you what the collateral is, Danny. It's that Russia is going to pay reparations when Ukraine wins. That is it.
And they're literally banking on that?
It is. That is the bottom line on the contract.
Oh my God.
That's the bottom line of the contract. That Russia, these are guaranteed by Russian reparations. This is a big gamble, isn't it? If you think about it. So that's why they're so desperate to steal this money, because that would plug the hole. Because right now the war bond thing, it's very tenuous. It's very tenuous because it's banking on Russia losing, but and paying reparations. Russia's winning. They're definitely not going to be paying reparations.
Okay, let's take a look at the foundation upon that gamble that they're looking at. This is a post from X here just a couple of days ago on the 15th by Julian Röpke, who's, you know, is very pro-Ukraine, a German, works for Bild, has been fairly accurate in what he's discussed over the years, what he's put out. But he even is finally, this is a long post here, but this is the top of it, the most important part. He's kind of disgusted by the situation here because he writes, however, the situation can no longer be glossed over by PR actions from the Ukrainian general staff, nor by the sugarcoating or ignoring of the part of the government in Kiev. Ukraine is heading towards a strategic defeat against Russia's invasion forces. And then he goes on to the whole thing to explain why that is. And he might as well have been watching our show because, you know, when you and I have talked about all the issues that are on that post, and it's just self-evident that that's the true statement. Given that that's the case, he's just calling out loud what exists, despite what all these claims are, like Manuel Macron, like Friedrich Merz, like Keir Starmer, who just want to pretend like none of that stuff's going on. But they have to know, right? I mean, right? They do know that what Julian Röpke is saying, what we're talking about, is what's real, right?
For this guy to say that, this was the head of the cheerleading squad from day one of this war. So for him to say this, that is a major canary in the coal mine for Europe. And, you know, look, Danny, you know, it's not politically acceptable for any European leader to wave the white flag at this point. And it's almost like they're engaged in a level of Soviet-esque propaganda. Everybody doesn't believe it, but they still have to say that publicly. Otherwise, the party, whatever that party is in Europe now, the war party, if you will, the globalist BlackRock war party, loses face. And you have total collapse in confidence in the system, and defeat is imminent at that point. That's why they have to, the leaders, these hugely unpopular European leaders, have to put this brave front up and just keep it all smiles, all positive. Yeah, we've got money. We've got money here. We've got money there. We got this deal, this new instrument, this new scheme, the latest one, this SAFE instrument. A month ago, there was something else. Then the month previous, there was another thing. Do you remember when they had the war? We're going to raise hundreds of billions, $750 billion to rebuild the
Europe. $800 billion is what the number was.
$800 billion. You remember?
Yeah.
What happened to
rebuild
that?
Rebuild Europe.
That's gone. And then it's been replaced three times over by this point. And that, now they're even talking about stealing Russian assets, holding them in escrow, and then gambling them on the world casino, and then using the interest from their winnings to fund Ukraine. I mean, talk about desperate.
But see, here's the we're just going to go down one more level into the rabbit hole of the disinformation or just incombobulation. I don't even know if there's a right word for this. It's just weird for the European leaders to be going down this path, gambling like you're talking about right there. And I see the path that it is, all the stuff that Rupka talked about. And of course, he's talking about the front line, the air war that's going in Russia's favor, the manpower issue, et cetera. And then you actually added something here on your X post about 10 hours ago, where you're talking about not just the lack of troops coming in, not just the casualties going out, but the fact that there's all these desertions. I mean, this huge number, according to what's this information you got here on your that you posted on your screen here, 161,000 through 2025 alone, and we're still not even finished with 2025 as compared to the previous 3 years. Well, I mean, what does that tell you?
Yeah, and this is discounting, you know, the many tens of thousands that have fled to Germany and other European countries that are you know, completely out of the system at this point. But it is, if you look at those, let's just say those are official numbers, and you look at the trajectory of that graph, that hockey stick is definitely going in the wrong direction for Ukraine. So that means that it means that it's just proof that the level, the skill level of the actual soldier on the front line is getting progressively worse and worse. They're not fielding, what are they, in their fifth army at this point?
Something like that, yeah.
Of the conflict. So, and they still have to keep, you know, their special forces intact and other people to protect the capital and to protect the government, and also use them as local enforcers, as a Praetorian Guard, if you will, for the Zelensky regime in Kiev. So, and Russia's going all in on drones. That, you know, and when I say Russia is fully mobilized, I'm talking about economically fully mobilized. They've geared their military industrial complex in Russia towards this conflict, and they're all in on drones, and they're all in on advanced missile tech and electronic warfare and all of these things that are this decisive battlefield factors of this conflict.
Now, it's not just you and I that are saying this, and most of the Europeans, and you just mentioned several of them, the senior leaders, Ursula von der Leyen, Kaya Kallas, Macron, you know, just a minute ago, obviously Zelensky, but there are some on the other side, and of course, from the beginning, Viktor Orban has been very crystal clear about where he is on this. He just came to Washington, where he almost directly to Trump in front of the cameras said that Ukraine can't win. When given an opportunity and pressed on it, he actually paused, hesitated, looked over at Trump and said, well, maybe a miracle, I guess, because he didn't want to say it in front of him at the time. But here a couple of days ago, he was not quite so reserved.
European politics intellectually is very sophisticated, but what they are saying basically means that they would not like to have a peace just now. They would like to continue the war. They think, and they speak about it publicly, that we have to continue the war to support Ukraine more. The situation will improve on the front line, and we will have a better circumstances or preconditions for negotiation. Wrong, totally wrong. Not to speak about geopolitics and human dimension, economically and financially is just crazy. We finance a country which has no chance to win the war, but at the same time, there's a high level of corruption.
No chance to win the war. He's just straight up saying that. Now, let me ask your opinion. Do you think that the Mance, the Macron, the Starmers, et al., Ursula von der Leyen's even, do you think that they know the same thing, Orban, or do you think that they have convinced themselves that it's not true?
I wish I can say that they know they know the facts, but they're just putting on a political face. But I do see there is a level of delusion of people that are not living in reality, not just in Europe, but also in Washington as well. High ranking people that are not dealing with reality, and maybe they're military commanders that are scared to death about telling the truth to the political leaders for fear of, you know, having their career cut short. Washington being the ultimate example of that at this present moment. Okay, the same goes for Europe. So I want to say, I mean, Orban's been consistent from the beginning. And, you know, a year ago, I was in Budapest, and we were meeting and speaking with heads of military, heads of government departments, foreign ministry, and so forth. And it was a unanimous, it was very clear, there was a consensus in Hungary a year ago that they're not interested in escalation. They want to be at the negotiation table yesterday, and that there's no appetite in Hungary for this. And it's not in Hungary's interest, or in Slovakia's interest for that matter, or Romania's interest for that matter, truth be known. Yeah. Everybody who's on the front line of that conflict, other than Poland, is not as hawkish as the British, the Germans, and the Americans too.
And I would even argue that the Poles are not that hawkish. They like to talk on stuff, but they don't want to be taking any action. It's going to get bombs dropping on their front yard either.
No. There's problems with this conflict in Poland. I mean, to put these crazy statements by Donald Tusk and others, but even Tusk will flip flop into reality now and again.
Flip into reality. That's quite a statement.
but like, I'll give you a perfect example. This sabotage of this train line, which hit Poland just in the last 24 hours, that connected Lublin to Warsaw. And immediately, as soon as there was news of this, you could see all the Europeans, everybody's making these statements. This is an attack on NATO soil. Just like 2 days ago, there was a Ukrainian tanker on the river bordering Ukraine and Romania. On the Ukrainian side, that was hit supposedly by a Russian drone. And immediately, a British MP, a Defense Committee, I believe, member Tom Tugendhat said, this is an attack on NATO territory, you know, and it wasn't. It was on the Ukrainian side. So Russia warned in September, their foreign ministry made a statement that they basically cracked they got an intelligence intercept about false flags. And that these would be coming in Poland and in Romania. And also we published the reports about Moldova, Transnistria, and that these false flags would be used to escalate the conflict and to reinvigorate the appetite on the European and Western side for conflict. So,
this point here, all war, according to Sun Tzu, is based on deception. And I think that we're living proof of that here. To what extent do you think that maybe some of these, maybe Russia's saying it's going to be a false flag, but it's really their flag, and they're trying to false flag, mm-hmm, to make it look like, but they actually want to send a message. How much possibility you give that?
I wouldn't rule it out, to be honest. I mean, because they're using asymmetric warfare against Russia. So it would be, Russia would say, well, we too can play at that game. But on the Polish train sabotage, which happened today, it was all this saying, oh, is a Russian attack, is a Russian attack. And immediately then the reports came out 3 hours later that they have two Ukrainian suspects in custody. And then now the media is doing a workaround in Poland and Germany saying these are Ukrainians that are working for the Kremlin.
Definitely.
So I don't know the answer to your question, Danny. I really don't. But what I do know is that it's the fake drone crisis. You remember the fake drone crisis?
Yeah.
About 4 weeks ago. That was, to me, part of that, you know, that was a probing exercise. For the potential for drone false flags is endless, just because of the nature of the technology. So but it seemed to me like that was completely fake, because you have to rewind a little bit when this happens. You say, how is it in Russia's interest?
Yeah,
to be sending a few wasps, you know, to hit a giant hornet's
nest. Unarmed in most cases, by the way.
I mean, it's just, it doesn't make any sense. And like the train thing, it doesn't make any sense. Now, if it was a false flag, that was botched on the NATO side, or they're trying to make it look like it was the Russians doing it. I still don't see the benefit on the Russian side. I would if they were losing or somehow, you know, but they're not. So I really don't know. They could say it's Putin sowing confusion. You know, they always say this in Europe. Yeah. Putin's trying to confuse us with his disinformation. He's so clever, this Putin, that he's trying to just dazzle us with false flags and disinformation. I don't know. But what I do know is who's desperate. Europe is desperate. Zelensky is desperate. Those are the desperate parties. So to me, the balance of probability would be the West and Ukraine would be involved in some kind of provocations, staged provocations that would somehow, you know, revive interest in this conflict and motivate the West, or at least the political West, to continue doubling down on it.
So I want to kind of shift gears here for a second, and this whole thing about desperate and false flag, unfortunately, kind of has some additional potential application in this hemisphere, not even in the Russia-Ukraine situation. That is in south of the American border, where some pretty weird stuff is going on and some strange comments coming out of Washington, D.C., especially the White House. And we're going to look at here at both Mexico and Venezuela. And we're going to try to figure out where this is going. First of all, President Trump in the Oval Office was recently asked about the possibility of attack into Mexico itself.
Also potentially launching strikes in Mexico or putting American troops or American personnel into Mexico to deal with
it. Would I launch strikes in Mexico to stop drugs? It's okay with me. Whatever we have to do to stop drugs, Mexico is... Look, I looked at Mexico City over the weekend. There's some big problems over there. If we had to, would we do there what we've done to the waterways? You know, there's almost no drugs coming in through our waterways anymore. Isn't it down like 85%?
It is, sir.
I've been speaking to Mexico. They know how I stand. We're losing hundreds of thousands of people to drugs. So now we've stopped the waterways. But we know every route. We know every route. We know the addresses of every drug lord. We know their address. We know their front door. We know everything about every one of them. They're killing our people. That's like a war. Would I do it? I'd be proud to. I'd probably go into Congress and say, hey, and you know what? The Democrats and the Republicans would both agree, unless they're crazy. But we have lost hundreds of thousands of people a year. Death. And that's not talking about family destruction. That's talking about death. And much of it comes through Mexico. So let me just put it this way. I am not happy with Mexico, okay?
Let's start off with the first part of that thought there a little bit. What kind of makes me think cringe is when you look at the map of where these speedboats have, none of which, and I mean none of which, had the capacity to actually get to American territory or to American ports. So no matter where they were going, they weren't going to the United States. And then to say that we have stopped waterborne traffic into the United States by 85%, and someone dutifully said, yes, sir, that's correct. And then you look at where the routes that actually come into the United States, and where you see where the illegal drugs enter, there isn't this large amount coming in from the water, and none of it is bought here. What do you make of that that statement there?
He's just making it up as he goes along. It doesn't correspond to what's happening on the ground. First of all, in the last 50 years, the biggest importer of narcotics into the United States is, or at least either exclusively or in partnership with cartels, is the Central Intelligence Agency. And that's not a conspiracy theory. That's very well documented. Okay. And to what level does that rise to would depend on how honest the United States government would ever have to be with its own Central Intelligence Agency, which is not very honest. But what is documented is pretty clear what the arrangement has been. That's how he knows the address of every drug dealer and the doorway and whatever the driveway and what car they drive, etc. And the DEA is also somewhat implicated in that as well. Not the entire DEA, but I'm sure certain regional agents in charge of certain territories, involved in quite a lot in there. There's a lot of money involved, and there's a lot of corruption. And to think that anybody in the U.S. government is whiter than white with this drug trade, I think is hugely naive. So what Trump is trying to paint a kind of fantasy picture there. First of all, the boat traffic that you've rightly pointed out, Danny, it doesn't make any sense what he's saying. It's ridiculous. He could say, oh, we've cut drugs by 90% this month into the United States. And everyone around him with their clipboard and Caroline Levitt and everybody else would just nod their head and say, yes, sir. Yes, Mr. President. Yes, Mr. President. That's right, Mr. President. Whether any of that's true, how they come to those numbers is anyone's guess. These fast boats that you're seeing right here, the only meaningful leg that they would ever do might be 90 miles from Cuba to Florida, possibly, you know, or from like the Dominican Republic to some other Gulf of Mexico or Gulf of America, as it's called by some now.
by some.
That type of trade, what you're talking about, it's meaningless. Not only that, but it doesn't make any sense to just basically murder and kill. If you suspect that it's a drug boat, wouldn't you want to apprehend it if you knew exactly where it was and then interdict it? And then basically you could find out, you could capture and interrogate and, you know, milk the intel out of whoever is driving that boat. And find out where it's coming from and so forth. And maybe what the precedent they're setting here, and he's talking about launching military operations in Mexico. Do you have any idea what this will do to U.S.-Mexican relations? And there's no due process. That's the point. And with this president that plays fast and loose with intelligence, claims, statements vis-a-vis Israel, vis-a-vis Iran, vis-a-vis Ukraine, and now with Venezuela. They're saying Venezuela is a narco state. This is a total fiction, okay? Where is the DNI, Tulsi Gabbard, on this issue? Is she going to present any countervailing facts or evidence to the president saying Nicolas Maduro is not the drug kingpin of Latin America, okay? Venezuela is not even in the top, you know, half tier. If there is such a league table in South America, they're not ahead of Bolivia. They're not ahead of Peru. They're not ahead of Ecuador. They're not ahead of Colombia. So what are they? If they are involved, they're in the minor leagues. You know, they're the Bush leagues for drugs in Latin America. So what are we really talking about here? And so this is what I see is this is a complete distraction. This is coming out of the desk of Marco Rubio. And they're literally making a case for war against a country that is not guilty of the thing they're accusing it of, and to launch an illegal, undeclared war of aggression against a country in a Western Hemisphere. And this is not U.S. enforcing a Monroe Doctrine. That's not what the Monroe Doctrine was about. This is an illegal war of aggression in order to destabilize, to decapitate a government, and probably, based on previous actions from the Trump administration and Biden as well, to seize the resource assets of Venezuela, of that country. And that's John Trump's been very kind of open about that side of things. So how on what planet is any of this legitimate or should be accepted? I mean, I really am shocked that if there's any U.S. military generals with any serious qualifications that will sit there in a briefing with a Fox News weekend host whose highest rank in the military maybe was major. I don't know how high Pete Hegseth rose.
Yeah, it was major.
Major? Okay, he's a reservist from Minnesota or something. And he's giving orders, illegal orders, to U.S. brass, and they're just sitting there and taking it? I mean, is this where we're at as a country right now? Because apparently this is very sad state of affairs, I think.
It is, and by the way, just because you mentioned it a second ago, I want to show this to those who may say, "What do you mean the CIA is involved with the drug?" This is from the Office of Justice Programs at the U.S. Department of Justice. I'm sure this preceded the current administration, or they would have scrubbed it. But this is going all the way back. This was written in 1993. Here, the big white lie, the CIA and the cocaine crack epidemic. And it talks about how we've been involved with that. To those who may not believe that that's the case, what do you know about that?
Well, let me add some color to that. So what they're talking about there was the trafficking of Colombian cocaine via Venezuela using the Venezuelan National Guard. This is under the U.S.-backed regime at that time in Venezuela. This is pre-Hugo Chavez, okay? And then through the Venezuelan National Guard, as helping to traffic with the CIA, doing the final leg to the United States. That's what that's about. And when Chavez came in, a lot of this type of complicity and trade came to a screeching halt, and ditto with Maduro. This is another reason why the U.S. deep state doesn't like the socialist revolution or this government in Venezuela. And there's another angle too, by the way. There is an Israeli angle to this, okay? And don't think that the fact that the first Latin American country to recognize the Palestinian state was Venezuela, and the South American leader that stood on the UN General Assembly floor 2 months ago was Gustav Petro, who called for Colombian troops to be mobilized to protect the people of Gaza. And Trump then suddenly says, we need to sanction this government in Colombia. Colombia has been a staunch U.S. ally and a top recipient, number four in the world, three or four recipient of U.S. military aid for many decades. But Israel was also involved in training the paramilitaries and maintained a military presence, either in the form of trainers and special ops in Colombia, and were basically turfed out recently, by the way. And, you know, the other big transporter of drugs globally is military. Okay. And whether that's, you know, traditionally the U.S. military has been implicated in the heroin trade from Southeast Asia. That's a well-documented fact. But other militaries, the French, the Israeli military, and other militaries involved in basically ferrying drugs around the world. This is one of the safest forms of transport that you can do for trafficking drugs. So at the moment, Israel has been turfed out of Colombia, now all of a sudden Colombia is public enemy number one, and there are implications that, you know, a big hub for narcotics in the Mediterranean is Israel for narcotics trafficking, and Israel itself has one of the highest per capita drug use for recreational drugs in the world. Highest per capita. They have a huge scene there.
We certainly
so I'm just throwing this stuff out there as kind of ancillary data so that people can see there's a lot more going on here than just the narrative that you're being spoon-fed by Fox and whoever.
And now I fear that the narrative that we're being spoon-fed now is in preparation for military conflict. Just a couple of days ago, the Rubio State Department issued a declaration that says that they're going to designate the Cartel de las Solas as a foreign terrorist organization, effective, important here, November 24th. So that's just, about 6 days from now. Based in Venezuela, the Cartel de las Solas, how convenient, is headed by Nicolas Maduro, who apparently is not just a head of state. He's not just somebody that we say was not legally elected, but he's also the head of a cartel, and now it's a terrorist cartel. And other high-ranking individuals of the illegitimate Maduro regime who have corrupted Venezuela's military, intelligence, legislature, and judiciary. So now then we're saying that the entire country is basically a terrorist organization, so now designated by the United States officially. And then simultaneous with that, you have this this peace advocate, the Nobel Peace Prize recipient, seems to be eager to say this regime's long and violent abuse of power is ending. A new Venezuela is emerging from the ashes, renewed in spirit and in united in purpose, like a phoenix reborn, fierce, radiant, and unstoppable, wrote the Machado, who was the recipient there, Maria Corina Machado. And one has to wonder, did she get her Nobel Peace Prize, and was she supported by the United States? And now that we want to put this peace-loving person in charge of Venezuela after we take the peace from them.
She is she's funded by USAID. So her election monitoring NGO is directly funded by our State Department, by USAID. So all of the people on the right who say USAID, remember when the whole Doge thing hit? She is a USAID sort of tool, if you will. But I think the Nobel Prize, it's beyond argument now that the Nobel Prize is somehow being run by the in the inside by the CIA, by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. I mean, it can only be that, because to give someone like that, who's calling for Israel to come and militarily intervene in Venezuela. Maduro was a bus driver, okay? He's a bus driver. So he won in a socialist landslide. He is working class. They love his profile as a working class guy. That's where his street cred comes from. That's why he is so popular. That's why he is the heir apparent to Hugo Chavez, because he got the support of the mass support of the people, because he comes from them. They're trying to recast him, the U.S. This is the WMD. This is Iraq WMDs all over again with salsa on top. That's what this is. That's all this is. That's all this is. The only thing more outlandish than this are claims that Hamas and Hezbollah are like waiting and hiding over the border in Mexico, waiting to pounce on Texas. That I've heard those claims, by the way.
Well, so what do you think is going to happen with this year? Because I mean, the fact that they chose the 24th of November for some reason, the fact that you have the USS Gerald R. Ford sitting there, biggest aircraft carrier in America's inventory in the world. Lots of combat power sitting out there. I mean, they're not going to leave them there forever. And now then the question, by the way, it's not just Venezuela, it's not just Mexico, but Trump has also in the last couple of weeks periodically mused about attacking into Colombia as well. So one has to wonder just, you know, WTF, what are we talking about doing here? Now, by the way, there's a lot of combat power to drop a lot of bombs and fire missiles. There's not any combat power to actually take anybody by force. So seriously, what the heck are we doing here?
I don't know. Something looks like it's going to happen. Any attack on Venezuela and then trying to cast it as self-defense in a war on drugs. These are like Donald Trump has borrowed the two worst things from the Clinton administration and the Reagan, Clinton and Bush one, which is the war on drugs and the war on terror. And he's thrown them into one omelet, basically. And
that's a good point.
And they're both failed policies. He's going to do nothing about the demand for drugs in the United States. There's a reason why people are getting knocked out of their heads on fentanyl and opiates and all these other drugs in the United States. There's a reason for that. And those are deep economic, socioeconomic reasons for that. And Donald Trump is not going to be able to address any of those by launching a war on a country. What he's going to do is cause a political maelstrom and a huge backlash in our own hemisphere against the United States. So all the goodwill that's been built up over the last 30 years through globalization and through improving relations with South American countries is going to go out the window. And he's going to do to South America what he did with BRICS, which he's going to accelerate the consolidation and solidarity within the BRICS bloc. Through this will increase BRICS solidarity as well, but also with left-leaning governments in Latin America are going to be totally emboldened by this, because Donald Trump's coming out and doing the thing that everybody accuses America of plotting to do. So it's it's a no-brainer.
So let me ask you this question, because this doesn't make any sense. From an analytical perspective of the United States, if you're doing something, let's just say that you just throw morality out the window and it's just cold power politics, calculations about what I can extract or whatever. I don't see us having anything to gain from this. I see us having a lot to lose, and I see this can just literally blow up in our face. We don't have enough combat power to do anything. If you did put anything, you're going to lose your domestic base, because the MAGA people that put him in charge are already upset about this, and that may happen anyway. But I just don't see any benefit. So I just got to ask, when Trump ran on, no more stupid wars, get out of the wars that were there, in the Russia-Ukraine war, et cetera, And that's why a lot of people voted for him. And so I asked the question, maybe there's something I don't see. Alternatively, and I'd like your view on both of these, is this evidence that maybe there really is something cognitively wrong with him?
Not just with him, I think with a lot of the people in his administration. I think you have, it's populated with a lot of people that are just quite frankly not qualified to be in charge of such important institutions. And with this amount of power and money, and that I think it's a problem throughout the Trump cabinet and his administration. And this idea that he can get a W, he's desperate for a clean win. Iran was not a clean win. It was not definitive. It was not a clean win. A lot of people will acknowledge that was done on behalf of Israel. Okay, and this is part of the fissure in the MAGA movement at the moment, and Israel is a big part of that. Trump wants a clean W, and he thinks he can get an easy win, a Grenada style win, a la Ronald Reagan, one for the headlines anyway, that will somehow turn the tide. But I don't think it's going to work. I think it could end up being a Falklands Malvinas type result that like Thatcher had with the Falklands War. You know, you have U.S. naval assets parked off the coast of Venezuela. You know, it took a handful of Argentinian Exocet missiles to basically ruin half of the British Navy, and hugely embarrassing. And really, that signaled the end of the British as a world superpower. That they had to incur that level of defeat to hold on to a handful of insignificant rocks in the in the southern Atlantic. So the same thing could happen here. It could be worse than that, you know, but I think Trump would use any U.S. casualties as sort of somehow fodder for a big explosion in patriotism for Americans, you know, dead U.S. servicemen to get behind, are you supporting these communist drug dealers in Venezuela? Are you going to support America? Pick your side, because that's what I think this president would do. And the people around him are so ruthless and feckless on this.
Not sure that would work. I don't think that would work.
It'll work. They'll have Fox behind them. They'll have a few media outlets behind them, but there's a level, the U.S. media are just not pushing back on this. It's like they're afraid of the administration on this.
Well, and yeah, some all of these lawsuits, there's probably good reason for that. I mean, and that was also probably by design.
Not only that, Danny, there's a specific problem with Venezuela. Okay. The liberal left, they through the policies of Biden as well, they're on board with regime change. This is the Democrats who are against the socialists now. You know, they're pro regime change in Venezuela. But these same Democrats would go to the wall against Trump. They're totally never Trumpers, but yet they support Trump in his regime change efforts. This is the duplicity and the hypocrisy of the type of modern liberal you have. The limousine liberal class in Washington are so compromised. They don't have any of their old left wing principles left anymore. All they care about is money and conquest. And they're as much chained to the Wall Street stock market fortunes as the neocons are on this, including defense stocks and everything else. So they're hypocrites in that sense. They're all anti-Maduro. They're all pro-regime change, even though it's a socialist government in Venezuela. I mean, so in a way, Trump knows this, and I think he's banking on that. That there's not going to be the pushback at the Washington Post and the New York Times and the liberal limousine class, the Democrats, are for the most part going to back this illegal war of aggression.
I think that all of them then, both the limousine liberals, I hadn't heard that term. I'm gonna steal that now and pretend it's my own. Or the Trump folks, or the Washington Post, or the, you know, all these other. I think that they are badly misreading the American people. I think that they are sick and tired of this, and I don't think that they're going to fall for this anymore, however much they're led to believe. I just don't think that we're just sheep to permanently be fooled. I mean, it's the classic thing. You can fool all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. And I think that we're about to find out if we go down that path. That's what I think.
And they also agree. You have to remember the Trump and Biden both green lighted hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans into the United States during these last 10 years on the proviso that they are pro-American and not pro-Maduro. And they did the same thing with Syrian refugees. If you announced that you were against Assad, immediate asylum in Europe, immediate asylum in Canada, immediate asylum in America. There's a geopolitical element to this. And then at the same time, the right are using the refugee crisis and all these Venezuelans, oh my God, how they get in here? They told everybody in the Republicans and the neocons and the Biden administration, they wanted them in. The Democrats wanted voters, and the Republicans and the Democrats wanted anti-Maduro, a bloc in exile that they could use to raise money financially. They've been playing this game with the Iranians and the MEK. This is part of neocolonialism. And now this game has come to a head. And Venezuela is that head. This is a make or break for this type of neocolonialism right now. And Venezuela is the tip of the spear on this.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see how this is going to work out. I still have hope that in between now and the 24th of November, that something good can be found, or that they'll realize this is not going to work, this is not going to help, and that we can avoid the worst for everybody who's involved, the Venezuelans on the ground, the American troops that might be at sea or in the air. Nobody needs to die over something so stupid like this. I just pray to God that we work that out. But in any case, I really appreciate you coming on today and providing such clarity on this, because you are also unintimidated and uncompromised to bring us the truth on this issue, and we're really grateful for it.
Thanks, Danny.
And as a reminder, if you can't get enough of Patrick, go to his Sunday Wire show, the 21st Century Wire. That is, what's that address there, 21stcentury.com?
Yeah, 21stcenturywire.com. That's
21stcenturywire.com. Yeah, don't forget the wire part.
That's the main website. Yeah, I'll put that on our banner next time. But that's the main portal, and everything's there. The Sunday Wire, the Midweek Wire, daily reports and articles. We're putting out also intelligence briefings daily on our main featured section.
Very good. Very good. And also on X, which is where I pulled some of the stuff off for our show today that I found on there. So be sure and look him up also on his X account. But we really appreciate you and look forward to having you back real soon.
Thank you, Danny.
And we appreciate you guys very much, too. Thanks for joining us today. Be sure and like and subscribe. If you haven't done that yet, it helps us more than you may think. And we'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.